Hey, good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. I'm Mike Causey. I'm glad to have you with us today. We always try to follow the money on this show here on Your Turn, but today more than ever, maybe, because we're going to be talking exclusively about phased retirement, unless you want to call in and ask something else. And I have one of the world's leading authorities here on it, Bob Braunstein. Bob worked with the National Institutes of Transition Planning. He is a former Fed, a retired Fed. He has been through a kind of a phased retirement. Wanted to ask him about that. And this thing is a brave new world. The government has never had anything quite like this. And as we've talked about in previous shows, you know, in the private sector, when you say we're going to have something like phased retirement, you just say, okay, Larry, you work 20 hours a week for the next 6 months. Georgia, you work with him, you be mentored, and then away you go. In the government, doesn't work that way. There are rules, regulations, laws that must be followed, all manner of things. The devil truly is in the details, and we're very, very close to phased retirement, but not quite there yet. So remember, we have Bob Braunstein. He is an authority on this. And that is saying something, because there are not many out there. And, Bob, you've been working with Tammy Flanagan on this issue as well. I know Tammy has done some shows with the National Institutes of Transition Planning, Bob Lyons Group. So, first off, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming down. And I know you're visiting from Florida. You came up here to escape the heat, did you?
No, I did, actually. I'm up here for a few months because I'm doing some additional work up here, too.
Okay.
So that's sort of reverse snowbirding.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, that's right. A lot of people do that. What's your background in the government?
Well, I worked for the government quite a few years ago. I was always in HR. My first federal position, I was actually a retirement counselor way back in 1970.
As a young guy.
Yeah, huh? I was 22 mm-hmm. years old. Mm-hmm. And I was in benefits for about 4 or 5 years, and then, you know, made the gradual transition to staffing and classification, went through a whole career. And then I took an early out with a buyout back when HR was being downsized. This was in the mid-90s. You mentioned before that I sort of took a phased retirement. For me, it was, all right, make a decision to leave early and then kind of go figure out what you want to do. Now, I had a buyout. I had lump sum annual leave payment, so I had stuff to tide me over. But, of course, I was taking about 50% pay into retirement with benefits. Had young children, had to do something else. You know, it's a brave new world now, because you don't really have to take the plunge that quickly. In my case, had to make the decision to go and then reset what I was going to do, you know, within the next 6 or 7 months. I was able to do that. I felt confident I could do that. But for folks who are a little tentative about it, this is a win-win situation. If you're given an opportunity to take a phased retirement, essentially you don't really sever the umbilical cord. You can stay with the government, get a lot of the government benefits along the way, and at the same time you can explore life on the outside, and you have the opportunity to, as you, like you said, help people who are going to take your place.
Well, when I was a very young reporter at the Washington Post, we did not have a retirement plan. Mm. They did not have a retirement plan.
That was a long time
ago. Until 1973. Uh-huh. I mean, the idea was, in those days, you worked for a newspaper, and you grew up and got a real job and left. There was nobody career. That said, there were some people that hung around forever. And I remember I used to hear the old codgers, guys in their 50s, talking about
younger than I am.
They
now,
didn't
yes.
know what to do. They were going to do with themselves in retirement. And I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'll be at Ocean City. Surf's up. We'll be out there. Well, of course, you grow up and you realize it's not going to be that way. But I have read anecdotally that a lot of people, they don't necessarily want to retire. They just want to work less, put in less time. So this is tailor-made for them.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, retirement of any kind is an emotional transition. And,
yeah.
and many folks who think they're not going to do anything are going to be rudely awakened. I mean, it's really important to add value. I mean, you don't have to be gainfully employed, but you want to be doing something that makes you feel good.
Well, I don't know how many times I've talked with people who were retirement professionals. They're financial planners, they're sociologists, what have you, and they say, don't retire from something, retire to something, even if it's a hobby. But
excellent advice.
Yeah.
Absolutely correct.
I guess one of the first questions here, this is from Josephine with the Health and Human Services. She said, when is it likely that phased retirement will actually be available? Do regulations need to be written first? I'm planning on going at the end of the year, but would hang in there a little longer if it looked like it might be available soon. Thanks.
Well, the regs are actually written. They were published in the Federal Register. There's a comment period ongoing as we speak, which is scheduled to end on August 5th, I believe. Once the comments are assimilated, I guess there'll be some final tweaks made, but I would anticipate seeing implementation of this in federal organizations probably by the end of the fiscal year, if not sooner. Agencies will have it in their authority to use this program as they want to. Again, you know, in Josephine's situation, the question is, if is she in a situation where an agency would give her an offer to go into a phased retirement scenario? Like you aptly said, it's not an entitlement. It really depends upon the employee, the organization, the type of job they're in, and whether it really is a match.
I remember when the buyouts first began in the 1990s, a lot of people said, I'm going to go into the boss and get a buyout. Well, it doesn't work that way.
No.
It is, as you said, it's an entitlement, and it has to work for the agency.
Absolutely.
And for the boss.
It's really strategic all the way down the line. Is it going to be win-win for everybody? Is the agency losing institutional knowledge because you're leaving?
Yeah.
They need to retain you longer so that you can train other people. If you don't fit that mold, not all jobs do, then chances are you won't get an offer to do a phased retirement.
Well, you know, in the late 1990s, I think the year it was 1999, the media started this drumbeat about a retirement tsunami, and it caught on, and it became a cottage industry here in Washington. Groups were set up and studies and committees, and they were all talking about poor old Uncle Sam would be an idiot child in no time. But as people who had the institutional memory and the knowledge retired in these great ways, well, it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
There have been dribs and drabs here. There have been heavy months, but by and large, it hasn't happened. But I guess it is inevitable. The numbers are there. Nobody's getting any younger. This huge lump of people that's beyond retirement age now. So could this mitigate that?
I think it could. Like you said, it hasn't happened yet. I think some of that was economically driven. I mean, when the market crashed mm-hmm. in 2008,
right.
It scared a lot of people, and they stuck around a little bit longer. But the baby boom generation, 79 million strong, not all of them in government, of course, I mean, continues to be the driver. And you got a lot of folks in government who are eligible to go, and I think they will be thinking more and more about pulling the plug now, but they can do it more gradually. So this could very well be impetus, because like I say, if you're not having to sever your ties and you can, you know, basically test the waters as a retiree, sometimes that's just more attractive. I mean, it's you definitely maintain your network of folks that you work with. It's not as scary. And again, for organizations, I think it's definitely a win because they maintain, you know, your knowledge, and you can help the folks who are going to take your place.
Yeah, because going cold turkey after working 30 or 40 years, I imagine could be an amazing jolt. And, you know, you sleep late for 6 days, and then you start confusing Saturdays with Wednesdays. And so this is not a bad thing. Here's a question from
sure.
Stan. It says, good morning, Mike. Glad to have you back from vacation. My question is, or your guest is, as an employee under the CSRS system, by continuing work under a phased retire, can I continue making contributions into the voluntary contributions program? That's a new one.
Mm-hmm.
Open to CSRS employees, or must I take final action, withdrawal, rollover, etc., when I go into the phased retirement, the same as if I was retiring, leaving government service? For people who aren't aware of the voluntary contributions, it's been out there forever. It's still not well known. But if you're under the old CSRS system, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can contribute up to, what is it,
10%
of your right. lifetime federal, which most of us don't have.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've made $1 million over the year, you can contribute $100,000 to this. It used to have a superb investment rate, a return rate, not so good now. But it's many people say it's the best thing in the world. It's the equivalent of a government-backed CD. You know, it's totally
right.
available only to CSRS. As people, and many of them use it to supplement their income. Very few use it to buy an annuity, but it is a perk. And if you hit the lottery,
sure,
coming with a lot of money, it's a great deal.
The great thing about it now is with the advent of Roth
yes.
IRAs, you know,
oh, yes.
This is a retirement repository or receptacle that makes that amount of money eligible for rollover to a Roth.
Okay, so better deal than ever.
It is, and there are no income restrictions
right.
with respect to the rollover, where there usually is as far as actually being able to contribute to one. So voluntary contributions are great.
Take a short break here on Federal News Radio. I'll be right back talking with Bob Bronstein about phased retirement.
When faced with opportunities and challenges, it's important to have a reliable.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey, glad to have you with us. And I'm talking with Roy, Bill Bronstein today. I always want to call you Roy. I'm going to ask you later on about
that. It's really Bob.
Well, you know what's funny? When I was younger, people often called me William, Bill, which was my father and grandfather's name, or Wayne. Because there was a Wayne Causey baseball player, so we beat him up that. But I have always thought of you as a Roy, and I wondered
if I look like a Roy.
Something in your
just
past.
Don't call me late for dinner.
All right, good deal. So Bob Bronstein,
yes,
here, and we're talking about phased retirement. It is coming up. He said the regs are being written even as we speak. The comment period is out there, and the question was from an Army civilian, Stan, who wanted to know about the voluntary contributions program. So we explained what that was, how is it affected, and he signed this: the door is open to retire. But is the voluntary contributions plan, has that been factored into this phased retirement?
When I read through the Federal Register's publication, I didn't see specific mention of voluntary contributions. But one of the things to remember is that when you're in phased retirement, you're still an employee. You can make contributions to TSP. I can't imagine that you wouldn't be able to do contributions to the voluntary fund as a CSRS person. Again, I haven't seen anything specifically that addresses it, but you should be able to do it.
Right, because that's just money from any source, provided it's no more
correct
than 10% of your lifetime federal
service. And it does not have to come from your biweekly payroll withholding like TSP does.
So you literally win the lottery, sure, or come into an inheritance, take that money
take
and
a loan.
Put it in.
Do whatever you can.
Good. Here's one from Heather with the, she doesn't say, says, I've been watching the news on this very closely. I have two questions. Is there a timeline for agencies to implement this program? Will it apply to Foreign Service officers? I am currently assigned to D.C., not overseas. I am in the FSPS system. That's Foreign Service Personnel System.
Right.
What about that?
Not sure about what the State Department's going to do. Again, it's probably better to answer a question like that by backing into who isn't eligible to be in it.
Okay.
And it's really, as long as you're subject or if you're eligible for immediate retirement and you've been a full-time employee for the last 3 years and you're not subject to an age-based retirement or like mandatory for law enforcement, air traffic controllers, or minimum retirement age plus 10. As long as you're, say, if you're CSRS 55 with 30 years, or if you're 60 years of age, 20 years of service, eligible for immediate retirement. Technically, your organization could make that offer to you. You've got to meet those background qualifications. Now, again, whether state intends to go ahead with phased retirement, whether they think it's something they can do, it's up to the organization to offer the program. They're not going to offer it to everybody. It's a question of whether it's a fit for them, whether it's a fit for the person who's leaving. So a lot of these are unknowns. I haven't seen specific mention of Foreign Service, but again, they're federal organizations, and the enabling legislation and regulations are out there pretty much for agencies to use ultimately.
You know what this reminds me of? Way, way back in time, the government started experimenting with a four-day week. And they were going to, they thought it would better serve the public. It didn't work. By and large, it did not work. But one of the toughest problems they had was convincing employees that while this may be a good thing for you, this is not designed for you. This is designed for the public. This is so that Social Security offices can be kept open on Saturdays or can be kept, have longer hours. So it's not about you. And I suspect this phased retirement is something like that. It may benefit you tremendously. It may benefit older people who want to go out, the middle career people who are in the promotion pipeline, and the younger people who will be mentored. But it's not necessarily about you.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's definitely preemptive and smart thinking on the part of the federal government and OPM to go out there and do this, given the age wave that we're talking about, this possible retirement tsunami and the outflow of institutional knowledge. It's a great way to keep that, at more of a trickle than a wave.
I imagine AFSA, the American Foreign Service Association, is very keenly interested in this and is probably pushing state to implement this. State has a slightly different system, and they have the kind of the up or out promotion system. But it would certainly fit there if it works out as part of their overall plan. Here's one from Tony in Merrifield, who's a postal worker, says there's a large retirement processing backlog. which phased retirements taken in large numbers would increase. Has OPM indicated they would process phased retirements ahead of full retirements to make the program an early success? Very interesting questions. It's related. Does OPM just process retirements first in, first out the door, or does it sort them to complete simple ones first, continuous service, one agency, et cetera? Good questions.
Yeah, it is good. Yeah, the backlog to which he's referring is actually being whittled down quite handily by OPM. Anticipated that it's probably going to be gone, hopefully, by the end of the year. They had quite a few cases, up to 60,000, I think, backlogged at one point in time, but they're getting through those, and it's anticipated that most of that should be gone. Processing retirements generally, if the agency has done its work well, usually there's about a three-month adjudication period. And once you leave, you get partial checks from OPM for about 3 months. Then you finally get a full check with all the back pay that they owe you and so on. That should be returning to normalcy pretty soon. And then phased retirements, it makes sense to process those quickly, and it's an easier calculation because you're only looking at calculating half the annuity. We're not adding the sick leave. A variety of things that we do when we finalize retirements make this a little bit more simple, plus the fact the employee is still technically working for the government. So it's not going to be as difficult to do these things as it would be a full retirement. There are a lot of loose ends that don't get tied together until the person is fully retired.
Well, the fly in the ointment is that OPM made processing these claims a priority at the same time the Postal Service was offering a large number of both buyouts and early retirements. Few other agencies added to that flow, so you had the retirement tsunami, the regular age-driven people, mm-hmm. plus the ones who were taking buyouts or early outs. And at the same time, along comes sequestration, and they had to eliminate overtime at OPM. So mm-hmm. apparently they're almost back to square one. They have more applications than ever before, not a record number, but more than ever before, and more than often is the case, and yet they can't do this with overtime.
Yeah, they had a big spike. I guess back in February they were anticipating 5,000 or 6,000 retirements and came up to about 20,000 or so. But they also hired more staff, and they've been really focusing heavily on getting the backlog down. And the reports that I'm reading is they've been making great, great progress. So for folks who are really worried about this, you know, who are going to be retiring regularly, I wouldn't see phased retirement processing being moved to the front of the line as necessarily something that's going to bollocks up the works with regard to a regular retirement.
Right. And the thing about this delay is many people, when they retire, the government estimates their annuity, OPM does, and then gives them something like 80% of it, which most people can get by on.
Right.
And then eventually you're made whole again, and you get retroactive payments and all that sort of thing.
And you get a lump sum annual leave payment. You can use that to tide you over.
Right. The problem is in these people, and we've all heard them, and I've talked to my colleagues at the Federal Times and other places, Washington Post, we've all heard from people who were put on 40% of their estimated annuity. And for them, that means cashing in the TSP. That means mm-hmm. borrowing to make the mortgage or the rent. And that is a real hardship. And if it goes on for a year, that's a major blow.
That's a rare situation. It's usually because there's a complex service history, missing data, or they might even be what's called a FERCA case. You know, they're in the wrong retirement plan and they're being, you know, they're in a 6-month election window to pick the old plan or the new plan.
Yeah. Okay. Here's one from Nuke at NASA, and he says, I've been pondering requesting a phased retirement when my time comes. I've read a lot of info about phased retirement online. My particular scenario has not been addressed in anything I have found so far. Perhaps Bob can help. I am now and always have been under FERS. That's the relatively newer retirement system. I'd like to transition to a phased retirement after 30 years of service and then stay on for another 2 years of phased retirement. During those 2 years, I will turn 62. My question is, how much, if any, of my service years will be subject to the 1.1% rule for calculating the retirement annuity pension of those retiring after age 62 under FERS, as opposed to the normal 1% of service for those retiring before age 62. My guess, I hope, is half of the years of service before phased retirement, plus the extra time served under the phased retirement, or in my case, 15 plus years, will get the 10% boost.
Wow.
I'm so glad you're here.
That's a great question.
I'm leaving now.
He's got half of his retirement coming in right now if he goes into phased retirement. And obviously, not being 62, then we're looking in the general formula of FERS, each year counts at 1%. So it would be 1% for each year times your high three average, and then you get half of that. The final calculation that's made when you retire adds your sick leave and then calculates the retirement as if you were never even in part-time status or half-time status. It says, all right, if you'd retired this day in earnest without even going through this phase period, here's what you'd have. So if you're 62 with 30 years of service, each year would count at 1.1% because you only need 20 to get that. It'd be 33% times the high three. But here's the kicker. We take that figure, that ultimate figure, and we cut that in half, too. And then we add the two halves together. So it's possible that that first half of retirement that you got in phased situation, obviously, was not based on the 1.1%. It's based on the 1% because you're not 62 yet. When we do the ultimate calculation, once again, it's like we do a full retirement calculation as if you'd never been phased to begin with, but we cut that in half. We add the two halves together. It's more than it would have been than before, but if you'd stayed as a full-time employee, it's a tough situation. My sense, based on what I've read, is that the phased period would be, you know, what it's phased for when you retire. But when you ultimately retire, it's the look back, looks at all of the service, applies the 1.1%, but then divides the whole thing in half.
Well, 0.1% doesn't sound like a lot of money.
It's 10%.
Okay. And so could you give a dollar example of how this might work?
If your annuity under normal circumstances, let's say I'm retiring, I've reached minimum retirement age, FERS, I've got my 30 years in, and my annuity, let's just pick a round figure, it's going to be $30,000, 1% for each year. Because you know, my high three was $100,000. Mm-hmm. If I was 62 and retired with that total, it would be 1.1% times my high three, or it would give me $33,000 a year as opposed to 30. So it's a 10% boost to the unreduced annuity total. Unreduced meaning the gross annuity before we take taxes out, survivor benefits, health insurance, and all of those.
So that's significant, especially when you consider COLAs, cost of living adjustments, are figured in. Even if, in the case of FERS, if they're reduced slightly, it's still a living, breathing creature. $3,000 more a year.
Yeah. Now, of course, if you don't get the 1.1% when you retire under regular FERS, say MRA 30, but you also get something called the FERS annuity supplement, which is that bridge to Social Security, which at 62 you wouldn't be entitled to get because you're eligible for Social Security.
All right, need to take a short break here, but we'll be right back. Thank you, Bob Ronstein, for being here. We'll have you back. Welcome back to Your Turn, Mike Causey. It's good to talk with Bob Bronstein. He is such a gentleman and truly a scholar in this esoteric but very important world of retirement. Coming up, talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. And, Sean, we've got an awful lot to talk about here.
We sure do. Where do you want to start, Mike?
Well, how about, I guess, do it maybe chronologically. New Year's Day, fiscal New Year's Day, is Tuesday. Even as we speak, Senator Cruz is filibustering in the Senate to try to block legislation that would keep the government running. What's happening?
Well, Senator Cruz is essentially, I guess this isn't technically not a filibuster, but he's been on the floor for around 19 hours or so, speaking against a bill that most of his Republican colleagues support. This is the continuing resolution that the House passed last week. On a pretty much party-line vote that would keep the government funded until December 15th, but would also strip out any funding for implementation of the Affordable Care Act, the health care overhaul that was passed in 2010, and it's popularly known as Obamacare. Now, Senator Cruz is speaking against the bill, trying to delay Senate action because he knows, and everyone else knows, that once the Senate does take it up, the chamber is controlled by Democrats. They will take out the Obamacare funding ban and then send it back to the House and let the Republican-controlled House leadership figure out what to do next. But most of his most of the Republican senators, including the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, aren't supportive of what he's doing right now. But it is definitely a topsy-turvy situation.
Right, and even most Republicans in the House apparently are opposed to this. But there's a group of 20 to 40 to 50 members who are adamant that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, this is the basically the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and the issue, the problem's becoming is that they're running out of time. It was expected that the Senate wasn't going to act or finally send the bill back to the House probably until the weekend. The final day of the fiscal year is Monday. And that doesn't really leave a whole lot of wiggle room for any kind of negotiation, compromise, or solution to keep the government going or the government fully in operation past Monday.
I want to get your feel on this. I was interviewed yesterday on another radio outlet, and somebody said, are federal workers jittery, worried about the possibility of a shutdown? And I said, as far as I could tell from what I've heard, not particularly worried. Many of them have been through this beforehand, or they figure there's nothing they can do, but seemed to be life was going to go on. By the time I got back to the office, I had a call from the top HR person in a federal department, and he said, wrong. Their people are worried. We're really getting worried over here, and we're having meetings, and people are concerned. What's your take on this?
I think they are worried. They have been through this before. I guess the closest call came in April 2011, where we were pretty much right on the cusp. I think it was an hour or so away from a shutdown. And Congress finally passed something. But you have to remember that awful lot of federal employees have undergone furloughs this year, so they've already lost some income. I think if there's any sense of calm, it's because they don't, at least from what I've been hearing from folks at agencies, they have not yet been told exactly how they will be affected if there is a shutdown, whether they would be exempted, which would mean they would come into work but would not be, would be paid retroactively once the government reopens, or whether they would be furloughed, in which case they would not be paid, and there is no guarantee that Congress, in this case, would agree to pay them, would agree to back pay at any point. So there's a lot of unease, but I think there's also a sense that there's not a heck of a lot they can do about it.
Well, I think you have situations, too, where a couple of weeks ago the Defense Department said there will be no more furloughs. In the new fiscal year, they said there might be layoffs, but there won't be any furloughs. And I think sometimes people are confusing a furlough versus a furlough. And this is not these would not be sequestration type furloughs. These would be shutdown furloughs, which are a different breed of cat.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's a good point there may be some confusion out there. Yeah, DOD has said that they would. If they had to go through another round of sequester-related cuts, that they would be looking at permanent reductions in the workforce. But in this case, under a shutdown scenario, they have to make a distinction between employees that are exempt from furloughs, whose work is deemed necessary, and have to continue working throughout a shutdown, and those who can be sent home without pay. And that is a different type of furlough. It's also, indefinite. It will last as long as it takes Congress to come up with some sort of funding bill to put the government back in operation.
Right, and unlike the furlough, the shutdown of 1995-96, that 21-day thing, where people were eventually paid, there's no guarantee this time that people will be paid. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, it's easy for Congress.
Yeah.
It's easy savings, and also you have the fact that they are gridlocked on so many things. It's unlikely you get any kind of resolution here. And I think it's worth pointing out that a year or two ago, a couple thousand FAA employees were furloughed because Congress left town for its summer break without passing reauthorization bill that was needed to keep some FAA operations in business. Those employees were furloughed for about 2 weeks. Congress never actually agreed to pay them retroactively. What happened was the Transportation Department, the FAA's parent agency, the lawyers got together and decided they didn't need congressional green light, went ahead and authorized the repayment anyway. No objections from Congress that I heard of. But I think that's telling that Congress, in that case, in a much smaller furlough situation, never made any real effort to ensure that those FAA employees were paid.
That's an excellent point, because I had forgotten that that's the way it worked. I knew they got paid, and I thought Congress got its comeuppance because some members were inconvenienced at airports because of the air traffic controllers. But you're right. In fact, it was an internal DOT decision to pay them. The numbers game. We're always looking at how many people are going to be impacted, how many won't. In the 1995-1996 government shutdown, the 21-day affair, something like 250,000 workers were furloughed. Many were not. And there's differences now. 9/11 has changed the government and the world entirely. We have much more emphasis in security now, and homeland security and law enforcement and everything, treasury, money laundering, and all that sort of thing. So the number of people that would be considered essential or emergency, I would assume, has gone up, and these would be people that would be exempt from the shutdown. But I saw a published report this morning from somewhere else where they said as many as 800,000 people could be hit by the shutdown.
Yeah, that's, OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, a week or two ago told agencies to begin updating their contingency plans for a shutdown, and those were last, I think, substantially revised back during the April 2011 episode that I mentioned a couple minutes ago. And presumably, OMB will come up with some sort of figure once those are updated or fully updated about what the numbers are. But 800,000 sounds plausible. You know, presumably, you know, folks who work in law enforcement, you know, TSA screeners, you know, will not be furloughed, but I could be, you know, or not all of them will be furloughed, but you know, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, do you have a feeling, a gut feeling as to how many people might be told to go home, come in, clean up your desk, and go home?
Not directly, no. I mean, it will definitely be in the hundreds of thousands. You know, back in the 95 shutdown, you know, most, for example, most Defense Department employees did come into work, and presumably that would be the case again. One other wrinkle we've got here is that with the end of the fiscal year, you know, agencies are basically closing out their books. And so it's possible that some folks in the finance budget arena who might normally be furloughed will be kept on just because they've got to make sure that, you know, there is, that people are getting, contractors are getting paid, that essentially there's no, that the government is following through on whatever financial obligations or statutory requirements it has to meet in connection with end of fiscal year requirements.
Well, let's assume we get through the shutdown. October 1 comes and goes, and Congress works its magic, as you pointed out, as it did in April 2011, with an hour to go. We're told by the experts that the real big problem is the debt ceiling limit.
Yeah, that is, I think, for most people who follow these issues closely, that's a much scarier scenario. Treasury Department today, I think in a letter from Treasury Secretary Liu, said the absolute maximum, and, you know, they've been using various gimmicks for the past few months to buy a little time, that the current projection is the debt ceiling will be reached, no ifs, ands, or buts, on October 17th. And, you know, this could affect federal employees. If the, you know, if the ceiling is not raised, the government will have to, you know, cut funding essentially by, I think, 35-40%. And the question then will be for Treasury to prioritize who gets paid, whether it will be, for example, countries or banks that hold Treasury bonds. Will it be federal employees? Will it be contractors? But presumably there would have to be, you would have to think with a cut of that magnitude that federal employees, at least some, would be significantly affected, you know, probably with furloughs.
Yeah, if it's one thing, it's another. Do we need to take a break? Yeah, Lauren Larson's giving me the signal here. Need to take a short break. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio, federalnewsradio.com. Mike Causey here. Welcome back to Your Turn. Talking with Sean Riley. He is a senior writer with Federal Times, and we've been talking about the obvious, the possibility of a government shutdown, and then followed, get through that, then October 17th, the debt ceiling limit comes up, which is really quite serious. And President Obama has talked about one or both of these events could plunge the nation back into recession.
Yeah, particularly the debt ceiling issue. Because it, you know, there are a lot of, you know, people, institutions around the world hold U.S. Treasury bonds. These are supposed to be essentially the most secure financial instrument there is. And if the government stops making payments on those, that has the potential, I think, in the view of many economists and financiers, to throw the global financial system into complete chaos with significant, you know, with potentially devastating impacts on the world economy.
Right, and China is one of the largest holders of these, in addition to European countries, and China has been struggling itself, as has Europe, and again, this could have a worldwide effect.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, I think in terms of the total, the potential impact, it's seen as more far-reaching than a government shutdown, which I should say, even if it happens, most analysts don't expect it to last very long. Polls show that although a majority of Americans aren't crazy about Obamacare, they're also not crazy about the idea of shutting down the government to try and defund it.
Yeah, doing it.
Presumably even in some of these solid Republican districts that members of Congress might feel some pressure.
Yeah, I think it's very significant, as you said, that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's a good, solid, down-the-line Republican, but he thinks this is nonsense. So.
Yeah, and he's facing, I believe he's facing a primary challenge.
Very tough one, yeah.
Re-election, so I think it is noteworthy.
Yeah. Health insurance premiums were announced yesterday. OPM says they're going up 3.7%, but if you look at it, and they always do this, if you look at it, the actual employee premium is going up an average of 4.4%. Now, that's pretty good, considering what medical inflation is every year. Only 4.4% is good, but I use the only in quote marks because people haven't had a pay raise in 3 years.
Well, that, precisely. I mean, it's still more than the Consumer Price Index. I mean, it's good compared to 8 or 9% for sure. But for folks, and we've been hearing from some of them who have, particularly those on family plans, you know, haven't had a pay raise in a couple of years, it's still more money out of their paycheck, you know, a couple hundred dollars per year that obviously you'd rather have stay in your paycheck. So it's really kind of a classic glass half empty, glass half full scenario.
Yeah, it's too bad. The government spends hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars each year on open season. They have equipment. The computer programs, they buy special programs for people, and yet only about 7% of the eligible people switch plans each year, meaning most people stay with the same plan they've been in for 10 or 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, some healthcare consultants encourage people to look around. I mean, one factor that OPM officials yesterday cited in the fact that they were able to keep the premium increase relatively low was increased competition, and plans do they do compete. They particularly now, I think I think it's fair to say that with the advent of Obamacare, they're supposed to be more straightforward about making it easier essentially for consumers to compare costs and benefits, and so I think it always pays to shop around. It's just, but it is a hassle. It does take some time to do.
Yeah, we all resist change.
Mm-hmm.
One in four people who are in the federal employee health plan are postal workers.
Mm-hmm.
The Postal Service, and I know you keep an eye on them, has been talking about a number of things, including a standalone or go-it-alone health plan. Where is that?
Well, it's nowhere at the moment. It's still, it's still on the drawing board of the Postal Service. There was a hearing last week before a Senate committee where the Postmaster General, Pat Donahue, and I'm looking at his prepared testimony right now, again reiterated that the Postal Service, you know, this is a key aspect of the Postal Service's business plan to return to long-term profitability. And in his testimony, he said that either pulling out of the FEHBP creating a plan within it for postal workers represents tremendous cost savings for the way the Postal Service provides health care to employees and retirees. And a big part of this would be pushing retirees to make Medicare their insurer first resort as opposed to the FEHBP. But it's still having a tough time getting traction. It's, the same Senate committee is going to hold another hearing tomorrow, which I believe an OPM official will testify, and it'll be interesting to get their perspective on this about what the possible effects would be on the FEHBP if, you know, one quarter of its participants pull out or are somehow detached from the plan as a whole.
Yeah, that's one of the things that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is counting on, is only the reverse. The Postal Service wants to push old people out of its plan into Medicare. The Affordable Care Act hopes that it will make insurance so attractive that young people, the young and the healthy, will buy into it, and that will improve the risk pool for everybody.
Precisely. I mean, they've got to have younger, healthier people who, you know, who don't get sick, obviously, as much as older folks do, to balance out that risk pool. Because if they don't, you know, provisions in the Obamacare, such as requiring insurers to cover people with pre-existing conditions, will drive up costs and without enough revenue to balance it out and make insurance unaffordable. At least that's a fear.
People are always asking us, what do we think is going to happen with a particular event like the shutdown? And to me, that seems like that's a sucker's bet, because I don't think the people that are working to make it happen or working to block it know what's going to happen.
No, they don't. I mean, I think it's fair. We are again, in uncharted waters. I think the, you know, typically the odds favor some sort of last-minute deal, as happened in April 2011. But at the same time, I think, you know, there's a certain segment of Congress that, you know, or segments of Congress that wouldn't mind a short shutdown. I think some of the Tea Party faction.
Drive it over the cliff.
Yeah, go
All
ahead.
All right, Sean, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. Remember, the show is archived on our homepage. You can listen anytime. We'll see you next week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Stay safe.
Thank you.